one of those things, you know, they were pushing, you know, they're pushing for time, you know, how it is. Icebergs, there was plenty of warning. They knew these things were floating around. They ignored the, you know, warning, and, you know, what are we going to do? They're going too fast. There were different times that, you know, you got to remember, 100 years ago, wow. I mean, they're using compasses, sextants, and God knows what else. Back to you, Dick.
And nowhere near enough lifeboats. And I think the declaration was that this particular iceberg was much darker in color, hard to see at night. Therefore, the lookout saw it, but too late, and the speed they were going and the amount of time they had. I think with hindsight, the way the ship was steered actually increased the amount of the gash that they... there were other ways the ship could have been steered that maybe it wouldn't have gassed as much. Have you heard things like that also before, Dad?
I've seen so many different shows on the Titanic over the years. It becomes a blur. You know, there's so many theories, things that have been knocked around. So I think the best stories were the ones that I just read in the QSD. I think they're very detailed and very informative. And probably, my guess, the way the ARRL is probably pretty accurate. But very good thing, I'm more interested in the electronics behind it than the actual politics and maybe corporate interest that went on that created that whole problem. Back to you, Dick.
I think you're saying, Paul, that from your knowledge, the best article is the one in QST. Are you saying that up till now you haven't seen Time magazine or any other magazine with a better article from a technical point of view? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, Time, well, I glanced through the Time magazine. It looks very good, a lot of good pictures and all, but technically, you know, with what went on with the radio operators and all, QSC is the best so far. I've got a book on a lot of different disasters over the years. I think I can find it here somewhere, but including the Titanic. It's got all the Scorpion, you know, the nuclear-powered submarine that went down, and all the different stories, every kind of disaster you can imagine, including the Titanic. But I still say the ARRL is the best.
Okay, that's very good. Stand by a minute. I just did a test to see if the 2-5 is operational. No, it's not. And I don't think West has the ability to get into the 375 machine. I believe, John, you've also found it difficult to get to the 375. You've got a lot longer distance to go. And therefore, for you, the 450 machine is the better one. Let me turn this back to you, John. See if you've got one more letter you could read. KC2WGB, K2LRW. KC2WGB, you copying me here, Dick? Roger, Dodger, I'm copying you very, very well.
Okay, no, nothing more from Mel's mailbag. But a comment on the Titanic, you're correct. The bulkheads did not go all the way up to the overhead, and that did create the problem, plus some of the problems with the watertight doors. But a direct head-on collision, believe it or not, it was a glancing blow, like Paul said, that cut that thing open, and there were questions of the quality of the steel and all that stuff that was investigated. But I think it was 5 compartments that flooded. And don't forget, it snapped in half. So whether or not, even if they had full coverage up to those compartments that were slid open, it may still have broken in half. So that's an iffy thing. A lot of history there. And by the way, there was a nurse that survived the Titanic who was on the sister ship, Mediterranean. She was on that. So she survived 2 of those disasters, by the way.
I think I do remember reading about that particular story. I believe the very last survivor of the Titanic has just passed, so there are no survivors anymore. So you're saying that had they hit it directly, the bow would have taken it. In other words, crushing the bow would have been all right. The gash along the side was not tolerable.
Wow.
And too bad they didn't have some better way of detecting icebergs. A sonar-like system, which I think hadn't really been well-developed yet. But on sonar, and not having enough lifeboats, they thought they would never be needed because the ship was, at least as far as the meter was concerned, unsinkable. It is possible, Paul, that had the tops of the compartments been covered with metal as opposed to being thoroughly open, that water wouldn't have had the ability to spill from one to the next. The delay time of sinking would have been a lot greater. Maybe the bow wouldn't have took place at that very tremendous amount of
oh my God.
If it came on my part, then maybe it wouldn't have snapped. It would have been strong enough.
Shut my God, you're fucking you.
Were really big, and you don't want it to snap.
Shut my God, you're fucking you.
Some of the airtight doors were troublesome. In other words, watertight.
You're fucking you. The whole trike is coming, you fucking you.
So once again, John, what was the question I was just asking? You said something about the airtight doors. Did the airtight doors, did the watertight doors not seal in time?
Cut open, and they even brought up a chunk of the metal that did see the metal testing because they thought that was, and don't forget, the water was very, very cold, and that made the steel brittle. That's another, it was another 15 degrees. There's so many, the perfect storm.
Now, once again, John, did you say the watertight doors did not seal correctly? I missed that part. Now, tell me what happened to the watertight doors. Did some of them not close, or not close in time, or not close properly? Over to you, John. Don't wait for the beep. Just go ahead, John.
Repeater. Time out. Ready. Welcome to the...
K2RIW listening.
Shut up, Dick.
Check if you want it.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Shut up, Dick.
So breakdown. It's got, you know... More things than any chick.
Shut up, kid.
Got a 3 Mile Island. It's got, of course, the Titanic.
It's got a Titanic.
There's hotel problems. All kinds of. That was the one that sank the submarine. It's got the a lot of plane crashes and all, so it's pretty good. Naturally, the Hindenburg, Apollo 1 fire, Soyuz 11 disaster, it's pretty good book. Breakdown, they call it. It's in the library or something like that. Worth reading. WSY.
Check the folder. Breakdown. Any idea who publishes it and roughly how many dollars is the book? How would you, Paul?
Hey, Bernie.
Years ago, Dick.
Hey, Bernie and Glenn, go fuck yourselves, Bernie and Glenn. You're going down.
Looking for usually a price in the back. I got this. It was probably about $16, you know. But, you know, you can get these things in a library. You tell them, hey, I want a breakdown, and they'll get it for you, and then they send you a letter and let you know it's in.
It's good to know. Did somebody else want to say something?
Dick, I'd like to ask Paul a question.
Go ahead, John.
Paul, in that book, the greatest disaster on sea, not on water, was the Empress of Ireland. Is that in there?
No, that don't ring a bell. The Empress of Island, no. The ones at sea, we got the Titanic. Naturally, the Andrea Doria, you know, when that collided with the Stockholm. We got the Thresher. The submarine that killed 129 guys. Scorpion. You got the Ocean Ranger oil drill. That was our drilling rig that sunk. And, of course, the Exxon Valdez. That's the one you have. Yeah, that's it for the sea, John.
What about the Shenandoah?
Shenandoah, wasn't that some steam-powered, that was big wheels, wasn't even on the ocean, right? Wasn't that on a lake or something, or a river?
Yes, I believe you're right. That was on, I think, the Mississippi. Greatest loss of anything on water. I think 5,000 people died on that.
Yeah, that was a real boat. Probably steam-powered with the big water wheels.
Do you happen to know what was the mode of failure in that case, John?
Veterans, and it was overloaded. That's why it went down. Interesting story, too. But the Empress of Ireland, I thought that would be in that book. That was a big disaster.
Give us a couple of words on Empress of Ireland. How many people and where do you believe it took place and what was the failure, John?
The reason it sunk, I'm not sure. It was coming out of Canada and it wasn't in the St. Lawrence Seaway, but it was up in that area somewhere. I don't even remember the date, but boy, the loss of life was horrendous at that time. But I know the Shenandoah was the greatest loss ever that I ever read about anyway. And you know, it paled compared to the Titanic paled compared to that. But amazing some of the disasters that happened at sea. And you had the Cyclops, which disappeared. They don't know what happened to that. That's another issue. Back to you, Dick.
But they would have the Edmund Fitzgerald, but they didn't have that in the book either. I think it has to do with what they know behind, you know, with the facts. You know, that's why certain things were published and not published here. You know, I mean, they have things like the Firestone, steel belted ties, and you know, things like that. The Ford Pinto. You know, the stories that they really know that, you know, 100% behind what went on here. Yeah, they got bridge collapses. You know, all that stuff. The Tacoma Narrows, the one up in the state of Washington, where they really know pretty much where the blame was.
What was the Cyclops, John? And once again, you may have said it, but I may have missed it. What was the mode of failure of Empress of the Sea?
Empress of Ireland, I don't know why it sunk. I don't know whether it was a storm or whether it struck something. But that was one. The Cyclops was, I believe, a coal carrier, and it disappeared somewhere in the Bermuda Triangle, if I remember correctly. It was a huge ship. I think it was had to be roughly about 1,000 feet long, I think. It was just after the transfer from sail and steam combinations. I think it still had rigging masts on the giant, and nobody knows what happened to it. I don't think it was ever found, either.
So I think you're saying it disappeared in the so-called Bermuda Triangle. Is that true?
Yes, that's what I remember. I'm reaching back in these days when I was reading the history of shipping. But that was a mystery. They could not imagine what happened to a ship that size. It just like was there and then it was gone.
Give me a couple of words, John, on the things that you have looked at with that macro lens so far. I know that it's you can zoom in and zoom out. I think that's electronic. And I believe there's a knob on the side that gives you variable focus. So you can focus at various distances, and I think you can zoom in and zoom out with the software. Give me a couple of hints as to what you've looked at that's pretty exciting. Because my son only had his laptop in operation with it for a brief period of time, and we didn't really ring it out yet. I got to wait till he comes back, or we'd like to get some Microsoft programming on one of the computers in our house. Over to you, John. K2LIW.
Yes, do that, because you'll have a lot of fun. What I've done with it, I've, because of my eyes, I can always use the better optics I have for working on these circuits. So I got tired of trying to hold a magnifying glass or have one on a gooseneck. So I tried using these to look at the circuit while I had this nice large monitor in front of me. I could zoom in on resistor leads. I mean, you could fuzz on the resistor leads. You could see the eyelets, whether the solder conformed completely around it. But when you wick out, you could see if you've got it perfectly clean. It's excellent for surface mount products. And I think if you run that into work and spend 10 or 15 minutes with it, you guys up there will have a lot of fun with it.
John, have you ever used a stereo zoom microscope while doing soldering on miniature circuits? I use a stereo zoom microscope at the salt mine every single day. And I wonder, have you used one of those, and what do you feel is the comparison? My guess is this thing is 100 times cheaper, but if you had your druthers, which would you use? Over to you, John.
Oh, without a doubt, Dick. I have a Bosch and Lomb, and I have a Zeiss binocular microscopes, and they go to about 80 power. I have different oculars I can put in there. But it's very difficult to work with those things with electronic circuits because the transport table or the transition table doesn't have enough clearance. But that definitely gets me in the ballpark. And one of them has a C-mount for, I can either take 35mm pictures or put a video camera on that, and it works extremely well.
So if I understand you correctly, you've got a Bosch and Lomb binocular zoom microscope that has a video camera mount, and therefore you can display that across the whole screen without quite stereo. I was about to ask you, do you wear stereo glasses when you're looking at the screen? I know the answer to that one. But when your head is directly in front of the eyepieces of the binocular microscope, I think you're saying that's the best. However, this is the second best and 100 times cheaper. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Yes, plus you can position it. It's so light. You can have any kind of a articulated arm, even a stiff wire to hold it exactly where you want it. And you don't need much lighting. That lighting that is built into it, those little LEDs, I think there's seven of them, they really illuminate the surface beautifully. And if you play with the knob, there's several adjustments on it, plus the software, and then import it into, Adobe Photoshop, you can have some real fun playing with those pictures. And you can take, like I said, still and sequential pictures, all kinds of things. And I have another one that takes interrupted shots according to motion. If nothing's moving, it just gives you that picture. Then if my dog walks across this area, you'll see her like in four different positions. It's really funny.
I wonder if you had a chance to view Wesley's videos that he mailed us. And although he can't talk to us right now, maybe we should make some comments on those. Over to you, John.
Yes, I saw the one he sent me with those glow tubes. He's going to use them in place of spark gaps. And he's going to put a capacitor in parallel with it. Now, the idea, the concept, let me let it drop for a second. What he's trying to do is prove that his hammering theory, which he has spoken to you about many times, works. So what he's going to do is get, I guess, two, like, pie plates for the capacitor with an air gap. He's going to adjust those, and he's going to have energy fed into this lamp. The right side, the energy will go in on the left side of the lamp, let's say, and he'll have the capacitor connected to the right side. Then at a moment in time, he wants to disconnect the right and connect the left lead to the lamp. And he thinks that the discharge from the capacitor, the one lead, going to give him that extra boost and build energy. And if it does that in a cyclical manner, he thinks he can gain more energy out of the circuit. That's what I understand from his explanation to me.
Okay, I think I see where he's going with that. My first impression is I think it's a long shot. The Geissler tube, when it breaks down, is a much softer breakdown, I believe. I'm not positive of this. I think it's a much softer breakdown. In other words, a higher equivalent series resistance when it's in the conducting mode. As such, I think it's not going to be as rich in harmonics. It's not going to be the same kind of an energy transfer that the normal spark gap is. It's worth the try. But because I believe the rather strong vacuum that's in a Geissler tube that gives you the glow effect. I mean, you wouldn't get that glow effect if there was not a reasonably high vacuum. But because they were a high vacuum, you do get a nice characteristic glow with dark spots on the side and things like this. But I think it's a kind of a soft breakdown that will not be as rich in harmonics. It's the equivalent of a step recovery diode that's got a lot of series resistance, if you know what I mean. So he's going to run that experiment, and when it comes to switching the capacitor from left side to right side and only using one lead at the capacitor, I'm having some trouble believing that that's going to be beneficial. What's your feeling on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Dick, I assume he's going to be using his AC fashion at some 20 kilohertz or whatever he's going to be running it at. So now I don't understand charge factor with one lead on it. Okay, he's going to get some charge, but that's going to take time. It's not going to happen instantly. So where do you pick the point he wants to be able to discharge the capacitor just before? He actually said he's going to discharge the capacitor just as it passes the rise time value of 90%. You know, the 10%, 90%. Just past that, let's say at 91%, that's when he wants to connect the capacitor on the left side. I don't understand how that is going to create a discharge from the capacitor without some kind of current being used in the right side. So, could educate me on that.
I think I'm with you on this one, John. Charging and discharging a capacitor, when you're only making contact to one lead of the capacitor, with all of my experience, would be very difficult. Now, if the one lead you're connecting is connected to a high enough voltage supply so that the unused lead is now developing corona, a kind of a voltage breakdown, to something, air, other piece of circuitry, or whatever, yes, you can get some charging and discharging in that manner. But if that free lead is not doing a coronaring itself, I think it's very difficult to charge a capacitor with only one lead. And almost all the circuits I have seen, there is a complete circle of known current flow through conducting devices required when you're charging a capacitor or charging a battery. But there's got to be current flowing in one lead, approximately the same amount of current flowing out of the other lead. And in the case of the capacitor, charge is built up between the plates when you're doing that. In the case of a battery, chemical reactions are taking place in the ions that are in the fluid in the battery when you do that. But without completing the circuit, like you, I think that the charge rate or the discharge rate could be very slow, and therefore you're not really going to be using the energy in the capacitor that you want to. That's my first guess on that one. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Exactly, Dick, because I referenced it to, let's say we had 1,000 volts of operation on this tube. We had a 1,000 volt battery, and we didn't connect it. Now we have one end, and at that time, we connect the positive or the negative lead to that one side. That battery's not going to do a thing. And I think the capacitor's going to wind up doing the same. I think we'll have the minimum effect. You have some air capacitors. You may have a little static discharge. You may have some charge there, but you're not going to get a decent current to make any effect, I don't think.
That sounds like we're in agreement. So that was the Geissler tubes. Those sprites are very interesting pictures. I mean, when Mother Nature makes a thunderstorm, the amount of energy that's discharged between one of those lightning bolts is just a huge number. And the fact that the discharge frequently between cloud and ground, sometimes between cloud and cloud, I think cloud and cloud is more frequent, cloud and ground a little bit less frequent, but at least one of those situations does create a blast of particles going upward into space, so to speak, that either give a red or a blue glow, and they're called sprites. And I don't think anyone has a clear explanation of what is the mechanism there. And the other video Wes gave us was the ball bearing connected to a screw that's held in front of a magnet, and then by touching it with a wire, it spins at 5,000 RPM. That's a rather acute, efficient motor. Over to you for comments on those, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Hello, gentlemen. I think we're going to put this fantasy out of bed now.
Okay, I think you're saying you recommend we wind down. Is that approximately the message, Eric? And you've got to get up early tomorrow, is what I think you're telling me. K2LIW.
Yeah, that's basically what I'm telling you. I've got to reset some stuff. I actually want to do a little work, and it seems like some other people don't want to go to sleep, so I bothered to turn the receiver back. But I tried a few times, and you saw what happened. So might as well put the imaginary out of bed at this point. So, you know, I keep my opinions to myself. Anyway, finish up, and I'm going to get it. C2RWK, here you go.
Very fine, Eric, and thank you for your help tonight. Back to you for a comment on that, John, and then I'll give the closing comment. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, one more important thing I forgot to tell you about the glow tubes is effect of the cosmic rays, which are going to help charge the capacitance plates. That is going to make the big difference. That's what Wesley feels. I forgot to mention that.
Yeah, under normal circumstances, the total amount of energy we receive from cosmic rays, I think, is small, but there I'm not sure. What you guys have heard tonight was TechNet number 1,392 of this series that began in September of 1982, 29 and a half years ago. And if all goes well, we'll be back next week and trying to discuss a little bit more of the science and philosophy and the pleasure of ham radio. How about you all? Be kind to each other. Be kind to each other. Occasionally that's not taking place in New York City these days. Hopefully this is a temporary condition. Bye-bye, you all. K2RW, to be clear.
Okay, Dick. Enjoy. Enjoy tomorrow. And thank you very much. KC2WGB.
Bye-bye, John.
Leslie, you want to go to 147?
RT25.28 clock. Not set. Clock not set. Ready. Clock not set. Welcome to the W2 lock not set. Not set. 7-3 and good from the W2.
Frequency, will you? Yeah, go to 00 or something. Because I need to be able to have a clear open frequency here. That's my only interest. Thanks a lot, K2J.
The time is 12 a.m. 7-3 and good from the W2 set tonight at 8:30. This is the W2 amateur radio repeater.
What are you, Dick?
morning. Time is 12. The time is 12:20. Welcome to the W2 morning. The time is 12:30 a.m. Is the W2 amateur radio. W2 morning. Time is 12:40 a.m. Good morning. Welcome to the W2 net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2L amateur radio.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
The time is 1:10 a.m. Good morning. The time is 1:40. Welcome to the W2. This is the W2L amateur radio repeater. Good morning. Set tonight at 8:30. W2L repeater. The time is 2. Morning. Welcome to the W2. The time is 2. This is the W2 amateur radio meter system. Good morning. Good morning. W2. The time is 2. Welcome to the W2L repeater. Good morning. Time is 2. Set tonight at 8:30. This is the W2 amateur radio repeater. Good morning. Welcome to the W2 repeater. The time is 3:27 a.m. Morning. Good morning. Time is 3:07 a.m. Is the W2 amateur radio repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. W2 repeater. Welcome to the W2L repeater. Good morning. The time is 4:50 a.m. Good morning. Is the W2L amateur radio repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Thank you.
don't stop on me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
that.
Thank you. Oh.